My name is Brian Kutz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I moderate this series with my colleague back in the back, Peggy Wright, and with assistance from our website and virtual library coordinator, Haiwan Wan, and our reference coordinator, Brian Carson. Our library technician tonight is Jason Hatman. Our speaker tonight is one of Kentucky's most acclaimed wildlife specialists. A native of South Dakota, he received his PhD in wildlife and fisheries science from Texas A&M University. He's worked for the South Dakota Game, Fish, and Parks Department as an endangered species wildlife biologist, and since 1988 has been extension professor and wildlife specialist at the University of Kentucky. He's a frequent commentator on wildlife management. You've probably seen him on television, and animal damage control, and a frequent author for such magazines as Kentucky Gardener, Kentucky Home and Gardening Magazine, Kentucky Afield, and Back Home in Kentucky. He's regularly seen on radio and television and has given more than 400 presentations on a variety of wildlife topics. In 1988, his first book, Gardening for Birds, was published by the University Press of Kentucky. He followed that up with a stunningly beautiful Kentucky's Last Great Places, of which we have copies up here, in 2002, which included observations, anecdotes, and more than 100 of his full-color photographs drawn from a 13-year exploration of little-studied areas of the state of Kentucky. In 2004, he published Wild Flowers and Ferns of Kentucky. And his newest book, although he tells me he has another one in the works, Rare Wild Flowers of Kentucky, which he authored with Deborah White and Mark Evans, and documents Kentucky's signature rare plants and includes 220 gorgeous full-color photographs done by Dr. Barnes. It's a real pleasure, Tom's just recovering from surgery, and it's a real pleasure to welcome him to talk to us in Kentucky Live tonight. Tom?
Thank you. Thank you, Doug. Would it be better if I stood behind here?
It doesn't matter. I think I just had it turned up to the left.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you for allowing me to come and visit with you this evening about the rare wildflowers of Kentucky. Working on the book was a great adventure. It was much more difficult to accomplish than I'd ever dreamed of. So what I thought we would do this evening is show you a few of the rare plants and talk about issues surrounding rare plant conservation. And then if you want to see the rest of the plants, you're going to have to actually, I guess, get a book. So I'm not going to show you them all. But with that, I guess we'll try and get going. I guess we're ready. And
real quick, let me try
to spot it together so that better. Sometimes, is that better? Oh, good. Sometimes, when you're in the field, you have good stories. Sometimes you have bad stories. This plant here is a southern crabapple, Malus angustifolia. And during the time when I was working on this project, that's a species that was actually taken off the list because the state had actually found more of it than they had found in the past. So they determined that it was no longer necessary to be on the list. But for those of you that have never seen this plant, it's one of the most beautiful crab apples you will ever see. So let me begin by stating that when I was working on the Wildflowers and Ferns book, I was using Mary Warden's 1970 book as a guide. And Mary had put flowering times in her book. And after about, you know, after the spring ephemerals were gone and May came along, I quickly realized I was in trouble because I was missing species. They were already done flowering. And the first one that I remember was a plant called Indian Physic. And I was so disappointed. And over the last number of years, I've observed that this trend is continuing. For example, last summer, there's a plant that grows around, actually around here, it's called the Glade Coneflower, Echinacea simulata. And you can always set your clock by June 10th or June 12th, that it'll be in peak flower. And last summer I was out, there's a great population of in a natural area over near, actually it's within the city property of Russellville, called the Baker Natural Area. They have, several, maybe up to 5 acres of these things in one patch. It's just a spectacular patch. And my niece was getting married June 14th, so the only time I could get out there was June 10th, and I was very disappointed in that the plants were almost all done flowering. Now, they still had wonderful, the wonderful pink-gray flowers, and it was still made for some very good photography, but that's easily 2 weeks earlier. And of course, we had a cold, wet spring. So there has been some research by Cornell and some work at Stanford that show that in fact, as global warming continues to kind of shower us with its unwelcome effects, that plants are going to become flowering earlier and earlier. And this has implications for the entire ecosystem, because there's a bird called the Dutch pied flycatcher. And this is a particular bird. It's a specialist. It summers in the Netherlands and winters in North Africa. Well, it's tied in its life history. It is tied to one particular wildflower and one particular caterpillar that feeds on this one particular wildflower. And those flowers are flowering 2 to 3 weeks earlier and then senescing, which means the caterpillars, obviously, are no longer on the plants. And the Dutch pied flycatcher's populations are plummeting because of that simple little change. And just to give you another example from the wildlife world, how many of you know what a red-eared slider turtle is? Anybody? That's one of the most common turtles in Kentucky. Well, we're worried about red-eared sliders because, like most turtles that lay their eggs in the ground, whether you're a boy or a girl is determined by soil temperature. And we're getting too many girls and not enough boys. It'd be kind of fun to be a boy, but ecologically that maybe isn't so good. And that's a very common species. So, there's reason to be concerned. So when we talk about rare wildflowers, what does that mean? Because a lot of people have misconceptions about what rarity really is. Rarity simply means that there are a low number of populations. Now, in some cases, there are some plants. For example, I discovered a population of nettle leaf sage in southern Kentucky. There were over 300 plants in that population. But there's only 3 populations of it in the state. So there are some biological reasons that plants are rare. One of them is this one right here, the monkey-faced orchid, or the white fringeless orchid. Actually, that's down the road here, that has a wide range specialized habitat. Where this plant grows in southern Kentucky, throughout Tennessee, and in North Alabama, but it has a very specialized habitat. It grows in something that we call an acid streamhead bog. Short's goldenrod, which used to be one of 2 Kentucky endemic plants. The other Kentucky endemic is, there's 3, this one right here. But Short's goldenrod has a very narrow range. It was associated with bison and the great herds of bison, where they would move along, they would create depressions in the ground, and they would create bare ground, and they would migrate down to Blue Licks, to the Salt Lick. So in Kentucky, that plant is associated with about 3 counties. And of course, they discovered it over at the Falls of the Ohio. So it has a very narrow range and a very specialized habitat. Now, one that's a really kind of a bizarre plant, which is this one, the heartleaf plantain, they're actually beginning to find more of it in Ohio. It's extinct in Kentucky. It has a wide range and a frequent habitat. And where they're starting to find this in Ohio is places where they've repeatedly burned. So that may be a plant that's a disturbance-adapted species, but, you know, grasslands were common, you know, and are still common in many areas. Another one is thyme. And this is one of Kentucky's endemic plants, the white-haired goldenrod. This plant only grows in the Red River Gorge. And it grows under rock houses and cliff faces. As you can see there, it's federally endangered. And the question is, there's plenty of suitable habitat in southern Kentucky and in the New River Gorge in West Virginia. The question is, why isn't it there? Well, like most goldenrods, it's pollinated by insects, it has heavy pollen, and it's not in a situation where the wind can disperse the seeds. So therefore, it just hasn't had time to get to those habitats yet. And of course, whenever you mention that, and humans think they're going to help, you know, no doubt some crazy human will collect some of those seeds and start fiddling with it. But, you know, biologically, it hasn't happened yet. Another reason is what we call a relic. Of course, the climate of Kentucky historically was not always what it was. You know, many millions of years ago, we had spruce and fir forests. And there are still some of those plants that hang on. Things like mountain maple or Canada yew, and you will see a Canada yew photograph in a little bit. And these are plants that typically occur in a microhabitat, typically on the north face of a slope in East Kentucky at a cave entrance, because you get that cold 50-some degree air coming out of the cave. It creates an environment much like you'd find in the state of New York. Now, almost all of Kentucky's rare plants, or the majority of them, are what we call peripherally rare. It means that they're simply occurring at the edge of their natural range. And this is the question that I get from everybody. Well, you know, if they're so common elsewhere, why should we care about protecting them here? Because we're at the edge of its range. What does that matter? Well, those are the plants that are the absolutely most critical ones to protect. Why? Because they are under selective pressures that other plants in the middle of its range are not. And this is the classic example right here, Cypripedium candida, the prairie lady slipper orchid. We are at the extreme southern edge of the range of this species. If you go up into northern states like New York, this is a common kind of wetland edge grassland species. In Kentucky, it grows in extremely hot, dry environments called a limestone slope glade. And so, perhaps, as we get this business of climate change as it progresses, this species may harbor the genetic material that holds a survival to that species. Because it is at the very reason, because it is at the edge of its range, and it is growing in a different habitat, it is selected for hot, dry. Whereas those that are in moist, cool environments, they may perish. And so that is why it is so important to protect plants at the edge of their range. It's a hedge against the future. So if we look at the issue of rarity within the United States, today about 17% of all the vascular plants in North America or United States are at risk of extinction. We already have 730 species on the endangered and threatened list, and more than 200 species have already gone extinct. And that number is certainly bound to increase. And in fact, in Kentucky, what we find over the last two decades is we're certainly adding more to our rare plant list than we're discovering new species in the state. And that's a trend that's not very positive. So, when we look at Kentucky, our statistics are pretty similar. About 14% of our plants, this is Carex apalachica, by the way, about 14% are officially listed. And the scary thing is that people think, oh, well, we buy all this land to protect plants. Absolutely not. Less than 6% of these occur on protected land. So what does that mean? That means most of our rare plants occur on private land. Now, you say, well, what's up with that? I will tell you what's up with that. Kentucky does not have a law that prohibits you from poaching plants from private land. We are only one of seven states where there is no regulatory teeth to our Endangered Species Act, meaning you can kill every single endangered plant you want and there are no repercussions, civilly or criminally. Third, Kentucky does not require any type of environmental assessment before development unless there is federal money involved. So if you have county or city or state money with no federal match, you can kill whatever you want, plants, animals, whatever. So we have very, very poor conservation laws in this state. And if you mention smart growth in this state, that's likely to get you hung up on the old oak tree out there. Now, here's the other scary thing. Almost a quarter of our rare plants are found in one place. 75% of our plants have less than three locations. You need 100 populations for stability. So what does that tell you about where on this seesaw ladder our plants, our rare plants, are? And you can see why we lose more than we're finding new species. This is a plant, this is a cotton grass, known from two places in the state. Okay. Now, here's the other sad news. We talked about federally 230 species, 61 in Kentucky. Now, they never completely ever call them extinct in this state. They call them historic. But 61 haven't been seen in 20 years. So, we've talked about the biological reasons. Now let's talk about the real reason plants become rare today. And it all revolves around human beings. There are basically four general categories why plants become rare. Habitat destruction, invasive species, harmful hobbies, and disruption of the ecosystem. Kentucky loses 130 acres of land each and every day to development. And as you drive around Bowling Green, you see it. Subdivisions, developments. You know, it's crazy. A few years ago, a decade or more ago, we had this whole business where they had this pot of money and the infinite wisdom of our legislative body to give this money to counties to create these development areas. So every county got this money to put in infrastructure to bring in industry. I cannot tell you in how many counties those things sit empty. But the reality is, when you lose land to development, it starts a domino process. And I'm going to give you an example. On I-65, and this has been, oh, golly, I don't know what, 20, 25 years ago, when they put the second Shepherdsville exit in to Kentucky 480, it opened up Bullitt County to development. Because now you have a quick, easy route into Louisville. You can be in downtown Louisville in about 20 minutes. So, one single act of putting in an interstate interchange. What did that do? Well, for those of you that have ever been along Kentucky 480, you know there's subdivision after subdivision after subdivision development, and that's where Bullitt County put in one of their big development projects. And in the 1960s, when you look at the aerial photograph, there's a place in the western, it's in the, what's called the western outer bluegrass. The type of habitat that occurs there is called what's called a dolomitic limestone glade. Well, at one time, there's this little place called Pine Creek, and in the 1960s, you can see this incredibly large natural area, several thousand acres in size. Today, the Nature Conservancy and the State Nature Preserves owns a little postage stamp of maybe 200 acres. But there was this incredible glade habitat and prairie habitat, grassland habitat, that extended into areas around there. And of course, as we develop, that affects it. Some of the largest populations of this plant, Spiranthes magna camporum, the Great Plains Ladies' Tresses orchid, which also occurs around here. And for those of you that are non-botanists like me, this is an easy one to tell apart from the other ladies' tresses in the fall, because see these little dudes? They look like horns. Cows, horns, Great Plains. And then when you get down and smell it, it smells like vanilla. So it's an easy ID dude. So anyway, what they did was they have developed this subdivision. There's a loop road that goes around Pine Creek Barrens. And they had these subdivisions. You know, people were buying 10, 15, 20 acre lots. And so they had rural electric, but they did not have rural water. So the county figures, well, we got to get these people water, you know, and paying taxes, you know. So, of course, because we have no laws that protect anything, the county goes ahead and puts in a water line, wipes out probably some of the best populations of this species and this species. This is another Kentucky endemic. This is the Kentucky glade cress. It only occurs in northern Bullitt and southern Jefferson counties. Nowhere else in the world. In the last decade, the population of this plant has declined by more than 75%. And it's due to one reason. Development. And you know, for those of you that like plants, you say, oh, it's just a little stinking mustard, you know. But if you look at the flowers up close, they're really quite beautiful. And, you know, if we keep getting this nice weather, this thing's going to be in flower in about 2 weeks. It's a very early flowering thing. The other species they took out is this one, known from two locations in the state. This is northern dropseed. It's grass. They took out one of them. So that simple act, and then to add insult to injury, instead of putting back native prairie plants, they seeded an exotic invasive, tall fescue, that will now encroach into the remaining habitat and degrade it, making it unsuitable for many rare plants. Invasive exotic organisms. This is another of our federally endangered species, named for a very famous ecologist from Cincinnati. Albert, you can't give this question away. Do any of you know her name? Her and her sister.
Lucy Brown.
Lucy Braun. This is Lucy Braun's rock cress, Erebus perstellata. Again, it's a little mustard, you know, spring flowering. This grows in about three counties, and then a couple counties in Tennessee. And you can see the habitat. It grows in the Kentucky River, kind of rocky talus areas. This plant is being threatened by oxeye daisy, Queen Anne's lace, and sweet clover. The state, on properties they own, actually have to physically go out and pull those plants. Now, how many of you love to go to Eastern Kentucky and see the beautiful waterfalls and walk the streams that are hemlock lined? Any of you? Well, for those of you that don't know, the hemlock adelgid is at the level that we call a severe infestation in the three mountain counties. And unfortunately, this winter, it was found at Natural Bridge. And for those of you that want to know what that looks like, go to the Smokies or go to the Blue Ridge, and all you see are stick forests. You know, we're a poor state. We have, it costs $1,000 to treat a single tree. You know, we're not going to be treating that, man. We got $50,000 last year. We all know the story of the American chestnut as an invasive exotic. And, you know, we still sell this stuff in the nursery trade. For example, there's a plant that's being sold. It's called Kogan grass. There's some variety called Red Baron. The state of Georgia spends $10 million a year trying to control that plant. And in Florida, where that plant is, it completely shuts down reforestation. And if it gets in Kentucky and escapes, which it will do, it will shut down our beef cattle production. So maybe at that point in time, which of course by then is too late, maybe then people will understand Kentucky has some of the poorest weed laws in the country. Now, this one is where gardeners come in, because, again, we have no laws that prohibit people from stealing plants. So, I mean, I give talks on gardening with wildflowers, and people say, oh yeah, we're out here, and I got some slippers, and I got some trilliums, you know, put them in my garden. You know, what's the biggest medicinal plant out there right now? Ginseng. And we have a history of collecting sang in this state. Kentucky is still the largest producer of wild collected ginseng in the world. Now, a few years ago, the Kentucky Department of Agriculture became a little concerned. And so they put in a little law that said you cannot buy ginseng root like before September 1 or something like that. Because the theory being is if you can't buy it until after that date, you know, the berries will drop, the plants will reproduce, yada, yada, yada. So because Kentucky has such a large producer, and we have hundreds of ginseng dealers, but there are 30 main ginseng dealers. And we knew something was up. So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service set up a little sting operation. So how many of those 30 major ginseng dealers do you suppose abided by the law? How many?
Zero.
Zero. You're absolutely right. They bought that stuff year round. And then the crazy thing is, when the feds put that stuff up for auction, who the heck? I mean, they were prosecuted under, how they got prosecuted was because they were selling it across state lines. So they got prosecuted with Lacey Act violation, which is a federal violation. Even after they got prosecuted and fined, they had a big auction for it. And who do you suppose bought that saying?
The dealers.
The dealers. Absolutely right. So, it's a real problem in this state. Another thing, our current governor and lieutenant governor have been promoting adventure tourism. Off-road vehicles. And have any of you ever seen what they do to the environment? Do they respect rare plants? Do they respect plants at all? Or something benign as rock climbing. There's a plant called French's Shooting Star. Some of it occurs not too far from here up at Yellow Bank Wildlife Management Area. I was up there last spring, and guess what? People that were going after artifacts had destroyed almost the entire population. Of course, digging artifacts is illegal anyway, but you know, in the Red River Gorge, the U.S. Forest Service has gotten to the point where they've had to close trails and put fences up to keep people from climbing up certain rocks and rock faces and shelters. But that doesn't even keep them out. So we, as humans, have a great influence then on the conservation of these species. The last one, Smokey the Bear should have had a 150 grain 308 bullet in him 100 years ago. Smokey was the most successful PR campaign ever. And when we stopped letting nature take care of itself with fire, lots of things happened. And this is an example. This is Canada frostweed. It's a beautiful plant, grows in the mountains. This is all little blue stem. This is a fire maintained species. And unless you burn that habitat, that plant disappears. The same thing, what have we done? Kentucky's lost 80% of our wetlands. We drain them. We don't like streams that go this way. We like streams that go this way. But once you affect the hydrology, you affect plants. So, why should we care? Well, there's some utilitarian reasons, and then there are some other reasons. And so, you know, you can look at this, and I'm only going to focus on two of them. This one and this one. How many of you knew that prior to Prohibition, Kentucky was the grape capital of the world, the wine capital of the world? We have an ideal climate for growing grapes. Of course, I guess in Prohibition they thought maybe we shouldn't be selling liquor and booze and wine and sort of things. So the wine industry left. Well, it just so happens in France, they had a big outbreak of something called Phytophthora, root rot. Any of you grow grapes in here? Any of you know what Phytophthora is? Well, if you get it in your grapes, you're done. Well, it just so happens there are four species of native North American grapes that have natural resistance to Phytophthora. Two of them happen to be on our rare plant list. One of them is the sand grape, and the other one is this. This is the northern fox grape. Now, when I was growing up, my parents didn't drink much, except for special occasions. And in their little rural town of South Dakota where I grew up, you know, the type of wine available was like Boone's Farm and and Mogan David. And so what did my parents buy but Mogan David Concord grape wine? The northern fox grape is a species that was cultivated to produce the Concord grape. Anybody in here had breast cancer or know of somebody that's had breast cancer? You can thank the cousin to this plant. This is Canada yew, which is rare in Kentucky, but its cousin, Pacific yew, they generated Taxol from, which was one of the first good treatments for breast cancer. Over 40% of all of our medicines are native plant derived. Why risk losing that storehouse of information? There are other reasons, and one of the reasons that we did the rare wildflowers is right here. Because we think wildflowers are drop-dead gorgeous, and they're just as beautiful as anything we can import from China or Japan or Europe. And I challenge you to say that that plant is any less lovely than anything you'll find anywhere. That's the native Indian paintbrush. Absolutely beautiful. So where do rare plants occur? Well, they can occur pretty much anywhere. But oftentimes they're concentrated. I grew over 250 species of plants and native plants in my backyard in the past. I don't have them now because I moved, and my friend Dave Svetich now has them, thank goodness. This is Juniperus communis, beautiful juniper. But in Kentucky, again, we said most of them are at the edge of their range. So the state has this approach. We can protect 80% of the species by protecting the habitat that they live in. So there are some major areas, some of them wet, some of them dry, some of them high, where large concentrations occur and the state has protected. The other method is kind of micro-conservation. But here's the rub. Remember, we said less than 6% are on public land? So there's a little bitty aster called the Tennessee aster, Aster hemisphericus. It's a beautiful little blue aster that occurs in one location in Caldwell County in a road ditch next to a subdivision. So how do you protect that plant? Well, you don't. And, you know, unfortunately, people that are in the business of conservation have come to accept those vulnerabilities. The other thing that's really important, and we think about, well, gee, if we could only get more land to protect things. Well, again, we're a poor state. You know, even the pitiful state of Illinois has more acres of natural areas in their nature reserve system than we do. Most of Illinois is a dang cornfield. So the reality is we focus on the areas that we can protect. So we look at big sites. So, you know, you might, for example, there's a plant called the grass of Parnassus. They're both acid form and limestone form. And, you know, the limestone form occurs at one place, one location, in a seep. The acid form occurs in a couple of locations. So, it just so happens the limestone form is on protected land already by the Corps of Engineers. So, what we try and do then is look at big areas, like Black Mountain, Bat Branch, or others. So, when you look at, for example, Black Mountain, over 4,000 feet elevation, more rare species occur on Black Mountain than any other place in the state. This is, of course, the rare species, Trillium undulated, the pate of Trillium. This is the only place where you can see southern red, large white, and painted Trillium. And in fact, we found a population of over 1,000 painted Trilliums in one spot. This is Turk's cap lily growing up right there, another species. This is the only location in the state for rosy twisted stalk. Biggest population of Lilium superbum, Turk's cap lily in the state. This is the only location for Appalachian bunch flower. Big lily. Stands like this tall. Only place for red-berried elder. Only place for Canada blackberry. Again, this is another easy ID one for us non-botanists. How many raspberries do you find out there with only one bloom? Not very many. And I got to tell you, last summer I was up there in July when the Turk's cap lilies were flowering and the blackberries had berries on them. Oh man, it was incredible. They're big old berries and they are sweet. And my two little girls had a lot of fun picking and eating. The only place for this plant, for the life of me, I can't remember the common name. It's Angelica triquinata. One of the Angelicas. Only known location for Virginia waterleaf, Hydrophyllum virginianum. One of a few locations for Steele's joe pie weed. This is another really easy one to ID if you're a non-botanist. It's the only joe pie weed with a fuzzy stem. So, you know, us non-botanists can ID it. Same thing here. With Curtis's goldenrod, it's got a grooved stem. This is the Roan Mountain goldenrod. Only known site for, again, I don't know the common name, it's Eupatorium maculatum. It's a northern joe pie weed. So, and this isn't all of them. There are many other species that occur up there. Now, if we come into more of the central part of the state, another habitat that, and this is a small little area of about, well, the opening is about 10 acres in size. It's a wet prairie, but in there we've got Laspediza Capitata. This is Harry Ludwigia. St. Peter's Wort. Broomgrass, Jim de Pogon. And Drosera brevifolia, one of two species of sundews in the state. And there's a whole host of other species there. Now, one that's closer here, to give you an idea, in northern Simpson County. This is at the other extreme. This is very dry. This is where the pavement bedrock comes to the soil surface, where in the springtime, the water has no place to walk, and it's like walking in a lake. And in the summertime, the temperature on the rock can be over 160 degrees. Ooh. I've experienced that. It's unpleasant. But we have this unique assemblage. And, you know, for one time, we can claim something on Tennessee. Tennessee used to have a bunch of endemic plants because this cedar blade habitat is an endemic habitat type, or we thought, to the Nashville Basin. Well, we discovered a few of them here in Kentucky. So, you know, a few things got taken off of their endemic list, meaning only occurs in Tennessee. This is one of them, Leavenworthia torulosa. And how do you tell this from the other glade crest? This is the necklace glade crest. See the necklace? Beautiful flower. Another one, Gattinger's lobelia, Lobelia gattingeri. And this is one that we really love to take away. And this is limestone fane flower, flower and hour, Talianus calcarica. Other things like stemless evening primrose, hispid false mallow, a quillwort. This is a primitive plant that you have to actually dig up and deal with the bud scales to identify. We've got two of them. One of them occurs here in Warren County. And our native privet, swamp privet. Now, one of the most unique habitats, and one of the habitats that I'm so fascinated with, not only because they've got lots of really cool plants, but they're really beautiful places, where some of the major rivers, like the Rock Castle, the Cumberland, even the Kentucky River, make a bend. Oftentimes, by where a stream will enter, they'll deposit gravel and alluvial soils. And some of it's inundated in the spring when the water levels are high, and then they recede, and then, of course, by summertime, they're hot, dry, nothingness. These are what we call cobble bars or gravel bars and the associated riparian habitats along with them. This is an example of a cobble bar. It's at Big Shoals in the Big South Fork. This is the rare plant. It's a plant called sweet fern, Comptonia peregrina. That's the entire population of that plant in the state.
Ooh, wow.
Dave, you know what that is? Only grows on cobble bars. American barberry. Or this one, which I think is absolutely lovely. Barbara's buds, Marshalia grandiflora. Or this one, Virginia spirea, federally threatened. Or this little Ceanothus, or Rand's goldenrod. Remember I mentioned the sand grape? This is it, grows on cobble bars. And one of our federally endangered species, the Cumberland rosemary, which smells like rosemary, it's a great plant. And the Rock Castle aster, sweet shrub, Boykinia, this is a northern thing, shining ladies' tresses, and this is another easy ladies' tresses to get because it's got a yellow throat and flowers in early May. It's the only one that flowers that early. And, of course, our namesake orchid, the Kentucky lady slipper. And this one actually occurs on the rocks close to the cobble bars, and the limiting factor for this, it is a vascular plant, it does produce flowers. But the limiting factor is pure water. And, of course, we know how we've treated our streams. This is a plant called threadfoot. And it's really interesting because whenever the water drops low enough and exposes us to the air, within a matter of hours, that plant can produce flowers and can get pollinated in less than a day. But the flowers are really, really minuscule. And here's another one. This is a triple carpus, and this one is a plant that doesn't even have a common name. And this one, now this one occurs, it's a globally rare plant. It's a lichen, so it's really not a plant. But it's a really, really cool lichen. It occurs along the Ohio River in Indiana, Kentucky, Illinois, and Missouri. And there are about 9 locations for this in the whole world. We have one of them in Kentucky. And it's really cool because it grows below flood stage on certain species of trees in the floodplain of the Ohio River. The best place to see this is at Cavin Rock in Illinois. When you take the ferry across the river from Salem, Kentucky, you cross the river and you go up and then you go left to some Forest Service recreation area. They've got a picnic area and they've got these cottonwoods and sweet gums. And if you look at it, it's at the base of all these trees. But it is a really, really cool lichen. This is one that occurs in the floodplains of the Ohio River. And it has an interesting name, Cida hermaphrodite. Yeah, boy and girl parts, same one. And then this is another one that occurs up there. This is a bur reed that also occurs up on the Ohio River. So I'm going to end by asking you a question. The United States has about 4.5% of the global population in this country. Less than 5% of us produce a quarter of all the greenhouse emissions. We consume a third of all the electricity in the world. We consume 43% of all the gasoline in the world. And we buy 25% of every single thing made in the world. Less than 5% of us buy 25% of everything made in the world. And people talk about, well, what happens when China comes on? Well, who's driving the Chinese economy? We are. So the question is, we know we're not going to stop global warming, and we know that we're not going to stop the global loss of biodiversity. You know, 30% of all the harlequin tree frogs are already extinct. So the question is, how are you going to respond? Because it's going to require action from all of us, each and every one of us. So let me ask you a question. In terms of your carbon footprint, what is the single largest factor that determines your carbon footprint?
Automobile?
Nope. Food. Food. Think about it. Think about the fact that you can go to the grocery store right today and you can buy blueberries from Chile. All the transportation costs, all the fertilizer, all the herbicide that goes into the production of food. So people ask me, well, what can I do? Buy your food locally. Go to the farmer's market. Grow a garden. Go to the orchard up here. It does a couple things. Number one, it supports your local farmer. It supports your local rural community. Number two, it reduces your carbon footprint. That's something really simple. You don't have to be like me and buy a hybrid car. You know, you can buy, you know, the fluorescent lights. But the single most large factor is think about where you get your food. So with that, I'll answer any questions, or at least attempt to answer any.
Question?
Yes.
You're obviously very passionate about this lack of conservation here in Kentucky. Have you done some lobbying with our state groups to help create some laws for our pathetic system we currently have?
Well, let me give you an example. It took 2 decades to simply get an endangered species law passed through our legislature. The only way the legislature would approve it if there were no regulatory penalties. So when we're facing a budget shortfall of $465 million, do you think they're going to care about somebody stealing wildflowers? That is so far down the list. I mean, Kentucky is poor. We smoke. We have a pitiful education. I mean, all these other issues. So, I mean, yeah, efforts have been tried. And every year they try again. I mean, look at the stream saver bill. Mountaintop removal that buries these streams. I mean, we have a gentleman that is like this with the coal industry that chairs the Natural Resources Committee. So you think you're going to get a law protecting plants through that committee? I mean, I'm not a rocket scientist, but I've got that equation figured out. It's just not the will of the legislative body. And unless the people of this state, it has always said, you get the kind of representation you elect, and that is very true in this state. We have got the kind of representation that we elect. And to 99.9% of Kentuckians, they don't even believe in global warming. I talked to a very well-educated man the other day. He said it's the biggest hoax ever perpetrated on this country. And I'm like, can't you look at data? Can't you look at science? I mean, don't you know anything? Oh, it's just a hoax. Well, look at the effects. It's already happening. Oh, it's just a normal cycle. I said, go back 400,000 years. I can show you data. Here's the cycle. Here's the cycle. Here's the cycle. And here's the cycle, and here's where we're at. So you want to tell me that's a normal cycle? I don't think so. So, I mean, you keep trying.
Do you have a favorite of all these wildflowers you've been through?
That's really hard to say because... you know, the orchids are always special to everybody, particularly the Kentucky lady slipper. But, you know, I think one of my favorites was when I found American barberry. I mean, that flower is about that big. And it's that bright yellow color, and it's kind of an interesting shape. And I got to tell you, this friend of mine, Mark Evans, who just retired from Nature Preserves, one of my co-authors, the only time I've ever stumped him. He didn't know what it was because he'd never seen it in flower. I said, oh, I can't believe it. So, no, I really don't. I mean, there's just so many beautiful ones. Some of the lilies and even some of the most tiny things, like you know, that Leavenworthia torulosa, the necklace glade crest. I mean, if you look at those tiny flowers, they're really, really pretty up close. So I really don't have a favorite.
What's your next book?
My next book, I have a contract. It's on the scriptural basis for environmental stewardship. One of the paradigm shifts that I've had, and I've thought about this a great deal, is that, you know, since the 60s, we've been educating people, supposedly, about the environmental crisis. Some things have gotten better. You know, we got more deer now than we had at European settlement. We got more turkeys than we had. But in the term, you know, we don't have the Hudson River on fire anymore. But, you know, at the same point in time, you look at things, for example, like they're starting to see DDT, or not DDT, mercury, and songbirds, and bald eagles in the Northeast. because the winds are taking them up and they're getting into the reproductive cycle. So unless we make this a moral issue and look at it through the eyes of the 85% of the population of this country that considers themselves to be religious, we're spitting in the wind. Because it obviously has not trickled down from our children. And so my thesis is that we have to have some sort of a paradigm shift to reach an audience that makes it a moral issue, that it's immoral to destroy what God gave us. And hope that, you know, that's a message that they can understand. And so I'm working with 10 theological scholars from around the country. They're doing the text, I'm doing the photography for it. And we hope that that's out by sometime close to Christmas. I also have a contract for a book on photographing Kentucky wildflowers that's on contract with the University Press. So those are the two things. I've got a couple other things. They want me to do a book on waterfalls, and that's kind of down the road. Yeah.
So you talked about the impact of food on the carbon footprint, and does that include eating less meat, especially beef? There's a theory that they fart, and their fart is more the emission of the air.
Methane is a greenhouse gas, but you know, if you look at it in terms of the data, you know, methane production from cows is pretty minuscule in the whole kind of scheme of things. Certainly, after just having open heart surgery, I can say I'm going to eat a lot less red meat, but it's not nearly as significant a source as burning fossil fuels.
You mentioned your garden of 200 plants that your friend now has. Where did you acquire those plants?
Nurseries. You know, for example, I was online the other day, and this plant is not on the state list, but I don't know, are any of you familiar with a native sweet mountain camellia? That's almost impossible to grow. I came across a nursery the other day that got it. Evidently, they figured out how to do it. Durr says you get about 1 out of 100 to take. And let me tell you what, we ordered, me and Dave and I ordered some, but I also noticed that they had Walter's Violet, which is on our list, and Nettle Leaf Sage, which is on our list. So I said, yeah, Dave, why don't you go ahead and order them, you know, because, you know, it's kind of, they're both really beautiful plants. And they both work well in a rock garden. So, you know, if you're real creative in how you search the internet, you can find anything in nurseries.
Are you sure it's not coming from a natural habitat?
Well, it depends on the nursery. I mean, you have to make sure you know what's going on with the nursery and make sure that the nursery says that they are nursery propagated, not nursery grown. And so we know how to propagate lady slippers and trilliums in the nursery. We know how to do it. The reason they're not widely available is because it takes 7 years to get a saleable plant. And that's why they're so expensive. So we can do it in the nursery. It's just a matter of what native plant one, you know, every native plant grower has their kind of own kinds of specialty plants that they like. Like, for example, the only place you can get Talinum calcaricum, the limestone flower and hour, is at Shooting Star in Georgetown. Because Mark Evans originally collected seed at Flat Rock and took it back and grew it. And so that's one of their kind of plants that they carry that no one else carries. So you just have to be creative in where you go. For example, like Canada Burnet, a common wetland plant up north. Well, shoot, you go into nurseries in New England, everybody carries that plant because it's kind of almost like a weed. So it's easy to find. And I've never gotten bad plants from a native plant nursery that's reputable. They usually come with a guarantee. They're usually very healthy. It's only when they get into my hands that. But, you know, I'm a perfect example. I grew, in my other yard, I grew pitcher plants, I grew sundews, and I grew Venus flytraps. So, you know, you can do all kinds of stuff in a garden.
One more question?
Yes.
Do you find that gardeners have a hard time with being told their hobby is a problem?
They do not like being told they can't dig stuff. But let me just give you an example. You know the hemlock adelgid? Well, there were some fine folks from Oldham County that went to North Carolina and dug a couple of little bitty ones. Most people can't tell what that plant is or what that problem is if it bit them in the butt. So they bring these back and they put them in Oldham County. And guess what? It escaped. And you want to talk about the nursery industry going ballistic, boy, they found every single nursery tree that had it and destroyed it. And they stopped that infestation. The same thing happened in Grayson County. People brought some hemlocks, brought them over there, and bingo. And I can guarantee you, this is a great story. I knew a guy that dug some dogwoods from the wild of East Kentucky, and they had anthracnose, and they infected every other dogwood they had in their yard. And I said, that serves you right.
Well, on that note, it's time for our door prize.
Is everybody in?
Everybody in for the door prize.
And we're going to give away one of Professor Barnes' most famous books, Kentucky's Last Great Places. Everybody in? Okay.
Gee, I didn't get in there.
Okay. And the winner is Gail Novick. On behalf of WK Libraries, I want to especially thank you, Professor Barnes.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank your wife for getting you here safe and sound. We appreciate that. And we have some modest quantity of books here. And if you'd like to get a signed autographed copy, come join us. And sure, if you'd like to talk personally to Tom, I'm sure he'd be glad to chat with you. And again, thanks very much. And we'll hope you'll come again to a Kentucky Live series. Good evening.